Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the next University of Tulsa presidential lecturer. Jared Diamond has expanded our knowledge of how early societies have thrived and died over the centuries through his popular scientific books like Guns, Germs, and Steel, which received the Pulitzer Prize, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, and The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies, his most recent. The World Until Yesterday combines the research on 39 traditional societies around the world, along with Diamond's own observations and research based on 50 years of visits and research to Papua New Guinea. Diamond is trained in physiology and is currently a professor of geography at UCLA. He's been called America's best-known geographer. His work draws on a number of fields from anthropology and ecology to evolutionary biology. He'll be the University of Tulsa presidential lecturer tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the TU campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. His most recent book, The World Until Yesterday, is published by Viking Penguin. Jared Diamond is my guest today. Jared Diamond, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's nice to be with you again.
Your most recent book documents your experiences of visiting, studying the traditional cultures in New Guinea over the past 40 years. Of all the places to go, what attracted you to New Guinea in the first place?
What attracted me to New Guinea in the first place, which was actually 51 years ago in 1964, was two things. One, at that time, I was 26 years old, young, ignorant, incautious, and I wanted to find the most adventurous, wildest, most untouched place in the world to which to go, and that was, of course, New Guinea. The other is that I was an ornithologist, and still am an ornithologist. I'm interested in birds ever since I was 7 years old, and New Guinea has the world's most beautiful birds, the Birds of Paradise, as well as a variety of birds equal to that of all of North America. So it's a great place to study birds and also to satisfy an ignorant 26-year-old's lust for adventure.
But obviously the people made a deep connection to you as well.
They're really interesting people. New Guineans, at that time, lots of them were still living traditionally. One of the New Guineans that I've worked with for a couple of years was on the last trip from his tribal area to get obsidian stone to make stone tools. So on the one hand, New Guineans, many of them still live in societies that are largely traditional, namely small-scale societies without state government. But on the other hand, they're people, and they laugh and they cry and they get angry and they're jealous about the same things that I am. So it's this mixture of exoticism and familiarness.
Now, in 1964, when had they had first modern human contact? Would that have been in the last 20 to 30 years or the last century or what exactly?
It varies with the area. Europeans were prowling around the coasts of New Guinea already in the 1500s and 1600s. But generally, they were cautious about going ashore because they were likely to be killed or to die of malaria. The first European attempted settlement wasn't until the 1820s, and it was abandoned within a year because half of the people died from malaria. Colonization on the coast began in the 1880s, but the largest populations of New Guinea in the highlands weren't discovered by the outside world until the 1930s, and even when I was working there, began working there in 1964, there were New Guinea groups that hadn't been contacted then. So long-winded answer to your question, first contact for tiny groups was in the 1500s, but for most New Guineans, it wasn't until the 1930s.
And one of the things you say about traditional societies is we shouldn't denigrate them as being primitive, and nor should we romanticize these communities as being sort of the same way we tended to do about our indigenous populations in the United States, Native Americans, Indians. We shouldn't do that because there are things that, as you write in your book, that we can learn from, but there are things we definitely wouldn't want to emulate about these traditional societies.
That's true. What's true for Native Americans is true for New Guineans. People are people, and some people figure out wonderful ways to do things, and some people get trapped in dreadful ways. For example, here's something that I did not practice on my children, and I would not recommend to our listeners. In parts of New Guinea where I was working in 1964 and 1965, I noticed a lot of adults who were missing one or more terminal joints of their fingers. They didn't have the last joint that had the fingernail. In some cases, they didn't even have the last two joints. And that's because it was traditional that when a older relative died, then a finger joint would be amputated from a child. That's something that I don't recommend. On the other hand, wonderful things that go on in New Guinea are the security of people in their old age, that they have friendships, they're living with their relatives and friends. There's none of the loneliness that most older Americans have to deal with. And ways of bringing up children. New Guineans bring up their children to be independent and self-confident and self-assured. So we shouldn't idealize them as being uniformly wonderful, but we shouldn't scorn them either, because there's a lot we can learn from them.
You've written that you had three stages of understanding of those particular traditional cultures you were visiting in New Guinea. The first was obviously how alien it was. And then after getting to know them a little better, you said, we're very similar. And then the third stage was, no, we are very different in many, many ways. Can you talk about how that understanding was shaped?
Sure. When I arrived there on the first day in 1964, it really felt exotic. So the people that I was working with in the Highlands, they lived in grass huts. They wore grass skirts. They still had stone tools around that they had abandoned using only the decade previously. So they were really exotic. And then as I got to know them, I discovered that they laughed when I did. They got angry when I did. They cried when I did. They got sick often when I did. So I thought, people are people all around the world. And then as I got to know them even better, it took me years to realize that in some basic respects, they're different. Their attitude towards friendship is different. Their attitude towards marriage is different. So those are the three stages that I went through.
If you could take one of those examples, their attitude towards friendship, how is it different?
Here's the difference. In the United States and in large societies in general, we make friends. And we select our friends based on whether we like them or not. We meet people when we're adults. They're not people that we've grown up with. And some of the people that we have as friends, they're people from whom we can gain advantage, such as selling the things or buying things from them. Other people, we make friends just because we like them. Well, in traditional New Guinea, friends were people that you grew up with. And the idea that you would then meet a stranger and be a friend of that stranger just because you liked the person, that was unknown. And it took me a decade, actually it took me 8 years before something that a New Guinean said made me realize that the idea of friendship just because you like someone is foreign to traditional New Guinea.
Mm. It's really about the clan and the group you grew up with.
It's the clan and the group that you grew up with, and it's also about whether you can get advantages from a person. You might make a relationship with a person because there's advantages to be gained from them, for example, a job, but the idea that you would make a friendship with a person just because you like them. I remember asking a New Guinean who had met a European teacher with me, and the New Guinean got along well with the teacher, so when the teacher left, I asked the New Guinean, are you going to go visit that teacher? To me, it was a perfectly natural question, and the New Guinean's response was, why on earth would I visit him? If he is going to give me a job, sure, but to visit him for nothing? Of course not. And it wasn't until then that I realized that the idea of visiting someone just because you like them was foreign.
Now, your book, The World Until Yesterday, not only chronicles your own experiences with New Guinea traditional cultures, but you're also using the work of other scholars in other traditional societies. Can we say that traditional societies are more alike than different around the globe, or is each fairly unique in their belief systems and their values?
Both of those things are true. There are things shared among all traditional societies, just as there are things shared among all large societies with state government. Any big society with a central government, whether it's the United States, Japan, Egypt, Europe, all of those societies are societies in which you encounter strangers. I don't freak out when I encounter a stranger. So this afternoon when I go out past hundreds of strangers, and I'm not going to panic when I encounter strangers. Whereas in traditional societies, strangers, you just don't encounter them except under unusual circumstances, and it's threatening and dangerous because they may be there to make war. So that's something shared among small societies and also shared among large-scale societies. On the other hand, traditional societies vary. As one example, of the 1,000 or so societies in New Guinea, there are two societies, only two that I know of, in which when a married man dies, it used to be traditional that his widow would call to her brothers to come strangle her. This was widow strangling. This was true of two New Guinea societies, but not the other 998. So that's just an example of the differences, but also the shared features.
You know, in a TED talk, you talked about how various traditional societies treat the elderly. In New Guinea, which is, I assume, they're not very nomadic at all, they treat the elderly very well. But if you were in a hunter-gatherer society, say the Kalahari or some other nomadic group where you're constantly moving, they treat the elderly very different.
It is true that nomadic groups tend to treat the elderly different from sedentary groups, namely that in nomadic groups, old people or people when they get sick may just be abandoned or they may actively be killed. And it's not because the nomads are vicious people who hate their mothers and fathers. It's because there's no alternative. If you're going to move every few days and each time you move you have to carry the babies and your possessions, it's just impossible to carry the old people. So that's the difference between mobile nomadic hunter-gatherer societies and sedentary societies. In sedentary traditional societies, in contrast, old people often get treated much better than in modern American society.
In fact, you say the elderly are pretty much the libraries, in a sense. They're the container of information.
That's right. If I forget what's the capital of France, you know, I know perfectly the capital of France is Paris, but let's pick something more that I'm more likely to forget. What is the capital of Zambia? Well, okay. If I think hard, I can find the capital of Zambia. But if I don't know it and I want to know what's the capital of Zambia, I don't go walking down the street until I can find an old person and ask them what's the capital of Zambia. Instead, I'll pull out my encyclopedia or I'll Google it, and there's the capital of Zambia. This illustrates that in modern society, our sources of information are predominantly writing, whereas in traditional societies, without writing, the sources of information are older people. That means that old people in modern society have lost what used to be one of their main values, namely the repositories of information. They've been superseded by Google, the Internet, and encyclopedias.
Mm-hmm. And in a lot of their traditional ways, they tend to be the person that knows the best how to, whether it's making pots or sewing or doing the essential work that is needed to keep that society together, they tend to know more than most.
Their knowledge is still of value because the rate of technological change is very slow, and so what you learned as a child is still operative when you're older. Whereas my sons are 27 and I'm 77, my sons get very frustrated that they've given me an iPod. And they've shown me how to use the iPod, but I can't remember how to use the wretched thing. And my sons, of course, they're fluent with text messaging and email. I don't own a computer, and every time that somebody tries to teach me how to operate it, I get frustrated. On the other hand, when I was a child, I multiplied using logarithms. I was really good at logarithms. I had memorized the multiplication tables. My sons and their generation don't know how to use logarithms because if you multiply, you pull out your pocket calculator. You don't have to remember that 26 times 26 is 676. You just punch it into your pocket calculator. So the skills that I learned as a child are no longer useful today.
My guest today is Jared Diamond, a professor of geography at UCLA, the best-selling author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse. His most recent book is The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. It's published by Viking and Penguin. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa presidential lecture this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. And I hate to say it, Professor Diamond, you sort of dated yourself by saying pulling out a pocket calculator, because now it's a phone.
That shows you, I'm twice as bad as I thought. Not only do I not pull out a pocket calculator, but I didn't even know that pocket calculators have now been superseded by phones.
Well, there are some really interesting things that you say we can learn from these traditionals. I'm interested to know about conflict resolution. I mean, certainly conflict resolution is a big part of our modern day societies, but it's also involved within the legal system, the courts. What do we learn from traditional societies about conflict resolution?
Well, any American who has been involved in a divorce or knows anyone who's been involved in a divorce, or any American who has had a car accident or insurance claim, or any American who's been involved in an inheritance dispute with a brother or sister or nephew or niece, any American who's been involved in the court system knows that it's usually a miserable business. Our courts don't care at all about restoring feelings, restoring peaceful relations between people involved in a dispute. If someone rear-ends your car, the courts want to know whether it was right or wrong. Were you in the wrong, or was that person in the wrong? And the courts don't care whether you are angry at that person who killed your child in a car accident for the rest of your life. Whereas in traditional societies, disputes are between people in your own village or clan or nearby, so you're going to have to deal with them for the rest of your life. The focus then in traditional societies is on restoring relationships, making it possible for people between whom something bad has happened to get on with each other for the rest of their lives. But our courts don't care about that at all. Hmm. Our courts just care about right and wrong.
Justice comes at a lesser pace as opposed to societal harmony or the ability of the two aggrieved parties to move beyond it?
Justice in modern society depends upon right and wrong. It depends upon the state having a monopoly on the use of force. So, for example, if I cannot settle a dispute with a person who wrecked my car, I'm not permitted by the state to go out and kill that person. Instead, it's the responsibility of the state to prosecute that person, because we have a government, and government does not want people committing violent acts against each other. Whereas in traditional societies, small traditional societies, where there's not a central government, you try to settle disputes peacefully, but if you cannot settle the dispute peacefully, then you take the dispute into your own hands by responding to violence with violence. So that's the downside of traditional justice.
Now, one of the areas that you write about, which you find admirable, and I had really never thought about it too much, is how traditional societies think clearly about danger. And you put it in terms of things we do 100,000 times with no problem, and then the 100,000th and first time we land wrong and we sprain our ankle. And it says traditional societies look at this very differently than Western industrial modern societies.
That's true, and that's one of perhaps the two most important profound lessons that I've learned from my work in New Guinea, namely to think clearly about danger. We Americans don't think clearly about danger. We obsess about the wrong things. We Americans, when you mention danger, we tend to think of terrorists and plane crashes, but vanishingly few Americans get killed by terrorists and vanishingly few Americans get killed by plane crashes. Instead, what we should worry about is slipping and falling.
Right.
That's a prime example. Perhaps something like half of Americans over the age of 70 are going to either die or are going to have their quality of life ruined forever by falling on the stairs, falling on ice, falling on the sidewalk. And we don't pay enough attention to falling. That's partly because we get used to the idea that if we have an accident, the hospital can fix it. But there are accidents that the hospitals can't fix, and New Guineans know perfectly well that most accidents cannot get fixed out in New Guinea. So New Guineans are just more careful than we are, and they're careful about the right things rather than wasting their energy obsessing about plane crashes.
So even though we think of them being totally at ease with their environment, they're constantly vigilant in their environment against, say, landing wrong on your foot, spraining your ankle. You're 2 days away from any sort of, if you're a day's journey away from home, you're not going to get back home.
That's right. And I will now give you an example of great practical value to all of our listeners. All of you out there who've not yet taken your shower today, when you take your shower, be really careful, because that's going to be the most dangerous thing that you do all day.
Slipping and falling in the shower, yeah.
Yeah, well, seriously, you might say, Jared, that's ridiculous. No. What are my chances of falling in the shower? They're 1 in 1,000. I say, yes, they're 1 in 1,000, and that's the bad news. Because if you're going to take a shower every day for the next 3 years, that means 1,095 showers. And if you fall 1 in 1,000 times, you're going to kill yourself once every 3 years in the shower. You better be really careful in the shower.
That's very funny. And, of course, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the things we worry about, you know, the odds are 1 in 1 billion trillion, you know, something like that. And those are the things that consume our waking fears.
That's right. The number of Americans who get killed each year in commercial plane crashes varies between 0 per year and 29 per year. But think about how much we think about plane crashes. Or the number of Americans who get killed by terrorists each year ranges between 0 and 3 each year. But think how much we obsess about terrorists. Whereas the number of Americans who either get killed or get crippled by falling, hundreds of thousands per year.
Yeah, car accidents, hundreds of thousands a year.
Yeah.
You know, you're thousands a year. My guest today is Jared Diamond. He's will be giving the TU presidential lecture this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center, lecturing somewhat on his most recent book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. In the book, he talks about how traditional societies treat the elderly, how they raise their children, dividing up space, which in a communal society I think would be very important. But let's talk about something we don't want to emulate, and that is the tendency towards unending warfare. What is at the heart of that in traditional societies?
At the heart of cycles of warfare is that small-scale societies don't have centralized governments. Centralized governments can declare war, but they can also sign peace treaties, and they can enforce the peace treaty. Whereas in a small-scale society where there's not a centralized government, if a clan, if a village has a war with a neighboring village, and they settle the dispute, but if there's then some person in the village, some hothead, who wants to start the dispute all over again because he or she is dissatisfied, there aren't police and there's not a government who will hold that person back. And so disputes that take the form of violence tend to go on and on because it's hard to enforce a peace. It's not that traditional people are intrinsically more violent than people in modern societies. It's that they lack the central mechanism for enforcing peace. Now, when I say that, I immediately have to stop and say, I can just hear millions of our outraged listeners saying, Jared Diamond, you idiot, don't you remember World War II and don't you remember Hiroshima and the bombing of Hamburg and all the people who die in modern warfare? And yes, modern warfare achieves big death tolls because there are lots of people in our modern societies available to kill, and you can kill lots of people at once with technology. But in traditional societies where wars just go on, the cruel reality is that the chances of dying a violent death each year are considerably higher than in state-level societies.
Mm. Is it the fact that the governance is sort of egalitarian, communal decision-making in these traditional societies, or what exactly? I mean, it seems like most traditional societies would try to keep the hottest head, so to speak, under control.
It's difficult to keep the hotheads under control if there's not police and not a government. If the hothead, as often happens, is a strong, intimidating person, people are afraid to confront the hothead. Whereas in modern American society, if there's a hothead, the police are not afraid to confront the hothead. Mm-hmm. And the police are armed and the hotheads are not armed. Or if they're armed and try to use their arms, they'll get arrested. Whereas in traditional societies, everybody has the same weapons. There's no police.
Now, of all the things you discuss in the book about the various ways, the differences in traditional societies, what would you say the biggest thing we can learn, the biggest area? Is it in treating the elderly? I know that's one you've spoken a lot about.
I would say the biggest thing we can learn from traditional societies is that there's not one biggest thing we can learn from traditional societies, but there are lots of things we can learn from them. I personally have been most affected by what I've learned from traditional societies about dealing with danger and about bringing up my children, and about perspective on old age, and about staying healthy. That's a good starter.
Yeah. In raising children, if anything, we have changed the way we raise children in, say, about one to two generations very differently that may have looked a little closer to the way we raise children in those traditional societies, maybe only two to three generations back. Certainly there were differences, but we've made a lot of changes in the way we raise children in the last couple of generations.
That's true. When I was growing up, it was reasonably common to spank children. Today, more people think that one should not spank children. Today, I think conversely, many Americans control and worry about their children much more than was the case 50 or 60 years ago. We are concerned about kidnappers and car accidents, and so we micromanage our children, I think, more than was the case 50 years ago. And we certainly micromanage our children far more than New Guineans or traditional people in general. In traditional societies, a widespread view is that the children are small people, but they're autonomous people who should be allowed to make their own decisions. And if they want to do something stupid, they will learn from their mistakes, and they'll quickly learn to be careful and have a sense of responsibility. They're allowed to make their own decisions, and the result is that they become independent, self-confident much earlier than do Americans.
Hmm. Well, we look forward to your lecture this Thursday evening. Jared Diamond, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure again to talk with you.
Jared Diamond is a professor of geography at UCLA and the best-selling author of Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse, and his most recent book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. It's published by Viking Penguin. He'll be giving the next University of Tulsa presidential lecture tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the TU campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. Information at utulsa.edu. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.